We will call to order the December meeting of the Finance, Government Services, and Operations Committee. Good evening, everybody. I know that Supervisor Reed has a interest in item four, which is the Latta Museum update, so we're going to wait till he gets there to do that one. So to give you a heads up, we'll go ahead and approve the consent agenda in a moment, but we'll take item five first tonight to get us started. We have three items on the consent agenda, which is contract renewal, job order contract for paving, surfacing, and site work, contract renewal, real property acquisition services, and award authority increase, roadway and civil design services for intersection improvements at Waxford Road, Pacific Boulevard, and Waxford Road and Broderick Drive. Is there a motion to approve? Motion's made by Supervisor Bona, seconded by Supervisor Bonfils. Any discussion? All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries 302 with Chairman York and Supervisor Reed absent. And Chairman York will not be joining us tonight due to another commitment. Let's go ahead and then move to item number five, if we can, comprehensive annual financial report for fiscal year ending June 30, 2015, and opinion letter from the county's independent auditor. Janet, are you kicking us off?
Yes, I am.
Great.
I just wanted to mention that FY15 was a second year closing of our books in the new Oracle financial system, and I'm pleased to report that we were able to complete the CAFR and our report to the auditor of public accounts on time by November 30th. So we have, let me introduce Rob Churchman from Cherry Beckard, and he's here to discuss the results of the audit and to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you, Jenny. Good afternoon. Good early evening. Thank you for having me this evening. I know you have a full agenda, and I will be relatively brief because I bring you great news. I bring you the news of an audit that the news you'd want to get. I do have required communications that I have to give every year to every client, regardless of size or complexity and so forth. So some of you are going to be saying, Rob, I heard the same stuff last year. Well, they didn't change, and I have to affirmatively present this to you each year. I have provided you a brief PowerPoint slide deck to utilize as a roadmap to make sure we cover everything tonight. If you could move to page three, I'm required to positively affirm to you each year what you hired my firm to do in the engagement services, to perform an audit to make sure the statements are or are not fairly presented in all material respects in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, to perform that audit under generally accepted auditing standards, government auditing standards, and also the state has some requirements for specifications they require my firm and I to look at every client. We also require to do some agreed-upon procedures for the county. Those are required by the state, and they're listed there. They are the same procedures that have been required in prior years, and currently those procedures are ongoing, except for the very first one, that item there, the comparative cost report, as Ms. Romanczyk said, was submitted on 11/30 in accordance with the state's deadline. With regards to my methodologies, really high level, we are a risk-based audit approach. We talk to our clients throughout the year, and when we come in at the final and to start the audit for the fiscal year that has ended, we ask them, you know, where are the riskier areas we need to be looking at this year? What may have changed operationally? What may have changed in the flow of activities and so forth? We plan our steps accordingly, and those steps do change from year to year. Then we will execute our steps, and as we're doing now, we will come in front of those charged with governance to present our results. With regards to some of the more key areas we look at the county, and these can change from year to year, as you can imagine, as was mentioned just a second ago, information technology, last year being the first year and this year being the second year under the new system, is an area we do look at each year as a significant area to make sure that there hasn't been changes in the processes and so forth and such. As you can expect, revenues and payroll being two large flows for the county, both in and out. We do look at those areas and test for example, in the revenue area, test for collectability of receivables and such. And in the payroll area, for example, we look at the changes in payroll, and especially this year, there was a very large change throughout the entire industry, I'll talk about a little bit later, having to do with the presentation of pension-related activities. On slide six, we also look at capital assets, capital construction in progress, to make sure that activity appears to be fairly stated. because of the level of money that the county receives from the federal government, we are required to do what is titled A-133 or single audit procedures each year. That is a significant area. Those programs do change from year to year, and we do have to test the cycles related to them, the control cycles and compliance. And then, of course, you would imagine a significant area would be financial reporting. How do the numbers get pulled together from the general ledger? If there's been any changes in required reporting from the prior year, for example, again, this year we call it GASB 68, but basically pension reporting changed dramatically and increased the thickness of your CAFR by multiple pages and multiple schedules. And we had to check to make sure that all those made sense and were fairly presented in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. Now the most important part, probably the most important slide in this whole deck, I leave it in the middle, we got to the point. Your statements are fairly presented in all material respects in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. That is an unmodified opinion. That's the terminology we use nowadays. But if you want to think of it as a clean opinion, that means your statements can be relied upon in all material respects. Also, if I had come across any deficiencies in control or compliance related to our work required under the government auditing standards, I'd be required to report those to you tonight. I have nothing to report there. Again, the exact report you want from your auditor on your financial statement report. With regard to slide 8, I wanted to bring you aware that we are working to finalize our single audit work, our federal compliance work. I wanted to make you aware that right now we are looking at 6 programs. Those programs change from year to year, as I mentioned earlier. They are somewhat dictated by the federal regulations because the feds do require larger programs to be looked at least once every 3 years. And some of the other programs aren't dictated, so they get chosen based on risk factors and so forth. Right now, we only have potential findings in the Medicaid area regarding eligibility redetermination. And also in the Virginia compliance area, we have a couple potential findings that we are vetting with management to make sure that we've seen all the information possible, that there's not another mitigating control or compliance step that would make that would resolve those compliance items. I will say that the items you see there, frankly, are fairly common across the Commonwealth. If you're going to have findings in the state compliance area, those are pretty fairly common compliance items. Before I move on, one thing I did want to mention to you also on this slide, the last item under federal programs, TIFIA, that is a new program this year. Obviously, it's a big program related to the activities here at the county. And because of the money that was drawn down this year, memory serves $11 million or so, we had to look at those drawdowns. And frankly, because of the size of the program, we'll probably be looking at it several years going forward because of the activity that's involved. But that is a new program this year. Slide 9, I just have a couple slides of my required communications. Again, you're going to say, Rob, I hear this. I heard this last year. I hear this on other boards I may sit on, but I am required to positively affirm these statements each year. Regarding accounting policies, we weren't aware of any changes to the policies in accounting aside from those that are required by the new generally accepted accounting principles for pensions. Also, we had one adjustment that was recorded in the current year for some land that was donated last year and is recorded as a current year 2015 transaction. It's immaterial to the overall financial statements, but I wanted to make you aware that that adjustment was made as part of the 2015 CAFR. Also, to give you a recap of prior year item, you may recall from last year that there was a difference of accounting between the county and the schools regarding little over $3 million. They weren't quite sure. They weren't able to reconcile who had the right number on whose books and so forth. On both entities' books, it was immaterial overall. I wanted to make you aware, because you would have seen it last year's report when I presented, that number has been resolved and properly recorded in the current year. I'm required to let you know that every set of financial statements, unless it's a really small entity that's only on a cash basis, is going to have some kind of estimates involved in it. The county has the standard estimates you see at an entity of your size and complexity, allowance for doubtful accounts on collecting taxes, OPEB and pension liabilities, risk management, and so forth. We look at those estimates each year to see if they make sense, to make sure that the information, the inputs make sense going into the calculations, that they are comparable and consistently applied from year to year and so forth, and we found that to hold true again this year. Some of these bullets look kind of ominous, and that's not intentional. It's just boilerplate language. There were no disagreements with management. There were no difficulties in performing the audit. We are required to let you know that management does provide us, under the auditing standards, a representation letter for Mr. Hemstreet and others to tell us that they are reaffirming to us that the statements are the county's, for example, they're your financial statements, that they're responsible for the preparation and compiling of those statements, that they made me full access to all information and data I would need and so forth. These are standard representations that are required, and in no instance were the representations changed from prior year or this year to our dissatisfaction. And then finally, again, it's an obvious statement, but I have to say it each year, I couldn't be here doing what I'm doing right now if my firm and all of my personnel were not independent of the county. We wouldn't be objective under the auditing standards. But I have to, again, positively affirm that to you each year, that we were independent. We do look at those kind of things, too. You might say, Rob, that's kind of a – you just say that to everybody. No. We do have mechanisms where we check to make sure that somebody doesn't have a relative or a close colleague working in the finance department that would be on my audit team and so forth. And this is where something like that does happen. I have to remove that person from the team, and just, it's nothing's wrong with them except that they have a relationship that could impair our independence. And again, in the cases of this year, as it was last year, no independence issues at all with our team. Those are my required communications. The last couple slides, frankly, are there if you can't sleep at night, you need something to help you get to bed, or about some changes that are coming in the accounting reporting and presentation. Some of them relatively, frankly, are going to be really big. The one here on 77, GASB 77, about tax abatements. That could be a sleeper requirement. GASB is now requiring, in 17, you'll be required, if you have any material abatement relationships with an entity where you've abated taxes for them to do something for your return, generally it's some kind of economic stimulus or a revitalization of an area, GASB is now requiring that those be disclosed in the financial statements. No liability or assets recorded, but disclosed. And as you can imagine, some entities around the United States, that could be a rather sticky presentation. There could be some abatement transactions that are going to be hard to get their hands around and to forecast the dollar amounts related to them. So I'm making you aware that this is a
coming. That would apply to the nonprofits and things like that show up in our budget every year as deferred tax. County has different relationships and agreements with certain entities that we don't collect taxes or we evade taxes.
No, this is really where it's here's an example for you from a statewide organization. When, for example, Tennessee tried to get Volvo to come in and build their plant in Tennessee as opposed to South Carolina or some other state, they provided them over $100 million of abated taxes relief, for lack of a better term. They also provided them $30 million tract of land for $100. That type of transaction wasn't required to be disclosed in the financial statements at the time, but would be required to be disclosed now, for example. The regular relationship you have with a not-for-profit and so forth, frankly, would not fall under this category, if for no other reason, likely because of the materiality threshold. You're not going to want to put on every $5,000 abatement you've done for some portion of a county or so forth. It's really for the material items that the citizens should.
What if it's not $5,000? We've got some pretty big ones.
Well, if it's pretty big ones, we'll have to look at and see if they fall under the requirements.
Yeah. In the millions?
But you've also got a very large, very large budget, sir. So, I mean, materiality, I want to also, I'm not going to try to spend time teaching. I do a lot of teaching, but materiality also is qualitative aspects, too. So we would look at the dollar amount and also the qualitative aspects of an abated transaction. The last item I'll talk on, and just on the second to last page, just to let you know, the county and the government industry as a whole went through a lot of stress and pain this year to put on their books for the first time pension-related liabilities because they were first-time required. GASB knew that they would be also requiring, in the near future to do the same thing for other post-employment benefits. As an industry nationwide, those numbers have trended to be very much larger than pension for various reasons, one being pensions have been around a long time, so they've been funded. They've been putting money into those liabilities, whereas OPEB is a relatively recent occurrence in the grand scheme of things for public sector. Also, OPEB, as a lot of places, has been tended not to be funded at all, period, even if it was there. So we'll be working with the county when that comes online in 17 and 18 to make sure that disclosures are proper in 17 and that the numbers are proper in 18. But I just want to make you aware that that's coming.
So do we have the actual numbers as a result of the, like, I know with the GASB chain related to pensions, what we're having to do now is essentially report as a liability the delta between what's funded and what's not funded, right? So do we have that? Do we know what that is?
It's the footnote number escapes me, but I don't have my CAFR with me.
When you look at the statement, Exhibit 1 in your CAFR, and you net out the deferred inflows and the deferred outflows and the obligation for the county, it represented $63.2 million. It's an increase to our...
Sorry,
$63.2 million.
It's a $63.2 million liability?
Overall, the net impact of it, yes.
Any other questions for committee members? Mr. Bono?
Yeah, just real quick. Looks like our results were very good, as they are every year. Unqualified, clean, that's what we want. One of the small little things here is untimely statements of economic interest. Do you attribute that to elected officials being untimely, staff? What did you find there? And I don't want names, but if it's elected officials, then we can correct that.
This is something that happens across the state pretty commonly. This year, maybe more than not, even more common because we went to twice a year reporting.
Right.
I don't have my cheat sheet right in front of me to say whether or not this was a first half or second half and so forth. But we are seeing that this is still something that is popping up across the state. It wasn't a ton of them. But it was. We don't have the flexibility with the state's requirements to say, listen, Rob, if you only see one, don't tell me. They say basically, tell me what you see. So I could get the specifics back to Janet.
There were two.
Yeah, but I could also get you the people if they wanted to, if you wanted to see the forms.
I believe, if I recall, these were two forms that weren't submitted in time for December. We had our audit last year. It was a little late. It occurred in January, and so that really happened before we put in place, some controls to have the county attorney follow up on these to make sure that they're...
Yeah, because there is a lot of follow-up that occurs. I know this last cycle, and just a month ago, there were constant reminders.
This happened actually before we received the comments from last year's audit, so it wasn't something that was addressed in time, but we obviously addressed it this time.
Right. We have the controls. One other, you're aware on the county side that we are 100% funded for our OPEB liability, so there's really not much for us to report.
Well,
there
I'm just like, no, if something would change in that matter coming forward, you have to put
right
on,
it could.
I have a lot of entities that are 0% funded, so I'm preaching to
we closed our gap and we're 100% funded on the county side right now. The schools are playing catch up, but they're closing their gap too, so thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Maybe we ought to just take care of the other audit item, which is item 6, internal audit for the Comprehensive Services Act program.
How about the auditor now?
Well, yeah. So, different set of auditors, Clifton Larson Allen's here to discuss their review of the county's Comprehensive Services Act program.
So we have Keith Novak and Taylor Powell, who have been here before, to discuss the report with you. And I believe we have a representative from Family Services, if you have any questions on the report.
Okay. All right, I guess we're the second half of the exciting part of the evening. We were engaged to look at the operations of the Comprehensive Services Act program, renamed to the Children's Services Program in 2015. We looked at the process. We interviewed individuals. We performed walkthroughs of the processes. And during our testing, we looked at a period of time in which there were 259 active files, of which we selected 25 for testing. And as a result of that, we came away with two findings and recommendations. First, I'd like to mention that the staff was extremely helpful to us in getting our work done in a very timely manner, as well as the electronic file system that's being used is extremely well organized and easy to follow. So it made pulling information a lot quicker for us. The two items that we had comment on, the first had to do with expense reimbursements. There are certain of these cases where there may be money that can be obtained to offset some of the expenses from external sources, such as Social Security, foster care, child support, and others. While we saw money coming in over those 259 files, we saw saw $143,000 worth of receipts. The problem is we don't know whether that $143,000 should have been $145,000 or, you know, more, because there was no real process to track what should have been expected to come in and what actually did come in. So we recommend that a process be implemented to start tracking what should be expected to come in on a case-by-case basis, and then reconcile that periodically to what actually did come in. And our understanding is that the county personnel are going to be looking at that process. The second has to do with quality improvement reporting. Excuse me. This department actually has a self-audit process where they do take a look at how they're doing. What we found, however, was there was no process for reporting that information out and reporting out findings and recommendations. And so we're just suggesting that a formalized process be put in place so that the findings of those self-audits can be communicated to every individual within the department to ensure that corrections are made and that everyone's aware of the corrections that need to be made. And that is basically the results of our work with regard to that particular audit.
Okay. I don't have any questions. Anybody on the committee? Mr. Bono?
What's next? We had an audit plan. Post-ERP, obviously, we can't do that right now. You have the Housing Choice Voucher and ADU audit underway, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, that is underway at this point.
And we should expect to see those results when?
Probably targeting the February meeting, I think, is going to be a realistic expectation for that report. We're currently in the field. Well, on Friday, we'll be in the field doing wrapping up some work for the affordable dwelling units and planning out some procedures for the Housing Choice Vouchers currently.
Okay, that one is of particular interest. Given there may be some issues under that one. We also approved four more down the road, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and we'll be seeing those this coming calendar year?
They'll begin in July.
They'll begin in
FY 17.
Okay, do you know which one's first?
Let me just see if.
One was grant compliance. I thought we already did that one.
Which one?
Grant compliance.
No, we haven't actually done that one yet.
I've not done
no.
grant compliance.
No.
Okay.
No, I don't think we've necessarily ordered them yet.
Okay. All right, thanks.
At this point.
So Sandy, go ahead.
I believe the first one's going to be countywide policies and procedures is the first one, first of the four. And then grants will be part of that, and then there's two others that will fall suit. Four.
Okay. Anything further? Thank you very much for the report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Why don't we go back now to item four, which is an update on the Loudoun Museum. I think Ms. Granfield is leading this discussion. There's been quite a bit of, well, quite a history at this point, including in this board's term, with dealing with the Loudoun Museum and trying to get it to be a viable operation. from a financial standpoint anyway, and staff is coming to us tonight with a recommendation for a path services path forward. It does require an investment from the board, so I'm sure there'll be some robust discussion about that. But Ms. Granfield, you want to pick it off?
Yes, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good evening, committee members. Megan Burke and I are bear with us, and we'll walk through the item. Bear with me, I'm losing my voice because of a cold. as you recall, in July, the board approved supplemental funding for the museum to the grand total of $91,000. This was due to the fact that the museum had approached the board and indicated that without the supplemental funding, they would have to begin the dissolution process and close their doors. Since July, county staff has met frequently with a working team, if you will. the members of the team are listed on page 1 and 2 of your item, included county staff, Gary Clemens, representatives from the nonprofit community, and several other folks. The group had a lot of energy, is all I can say. They were dedicated to discussing and ferreting out the issue, past issues, current issues of the museum, and creating an operational plan that could hopefully lead for sustained success in the future. As you are also aware, several years ago in 2012, the museum provided the board with a turnaround business plan. In brief, the plan was never fully implemented, and it's our opinion that generally there is not a focus on fundraising and development, but rather on operations in the museum. One piece of our recommendation, going back to the business plan, we also believe that the museum does not have sufficient staff in service to fully development and do fundraising. The board board of trustees is not a giving board, more than an operational board that contributes to the operations of the museum. Some do contribute financially, but most of them contribute in-kind services rather than through donations. We believe that if an executive oversight committee was formed for a temporary period, say up to 2 years, formed and appointed by the county administrator, that executive oversight committee could provide assistance and guidance to the museum in several areas, recruiting trustees that can commit to annual contributions that can and will, hiring a development manager, and completion and execution of a development plan for the museum. One part of the working group that was indicated or that was prevalent was the degree of community partners that are out there, not just in the working group, but the phone calls that have come in as this process has unfolded. Both the citizens and the community at large want to keep the museum doors open and want it to remain operational. As I mentioned, we believe that we need to put in place a formal and executable development plan. It would set up the framework for short and long-term goals and objectives, including hiring a development manager that would be 100% focused on development and fundraising. It's considerate an investment of money to increase funding to come back to the museum. There are whole areas of the county that have not been tapped. The private sector, including large and small businesses, educational institutions, other nonprofits, and individual members, and including creating a stable base of volunteers. Excuse me. We think a development manager can start to forge those linkages. Mr. Reiser was part of the working group. I asked him, buddy, if we get something that we can sell and market, can you help us and open some doors to corporations and businesses? And he said yes. And I think that's possible. It just hasn't been the focus of the staff or the board of trustees of the museum. Over the last 5 months, the museum has accomplished some short-term goals that I wanted to draw to your attention. They extended the hauntings time frame, hauntings, popular haunting series, brought in more money of that event. Some membership has increased, and they have a scheduled presentation before the Chamber of Commerce in January, along with a representative from Visit Loudoun. Most notably, I think it was within the last week, they were notified that they received a $5,000 grant from Virginia Power and Department of Historic Resources. So that's really good news. And they've taken some positive steps to move forward. Let me turn it over to Megan now, who will go forward.
So over the longer term, the Museum Working Group has proposed some additional goals that could be accomplished over the next 12 months, including board composition changes. 7 members are up for renewal during the next year, and the museum board is encouraged to find board members that would be willing to change the board over to be more of a giving board. That's definitely something that the Museum Working Group was supportive of. In addition, we talked about developing targeted corporate partnerships and sponsorship opportunities, working with Visit Loudoun and the Chamber of Commerce. We also discussed programming development, enhancement, and actually satellite locations for both artifacts as well as programming. An idea of traveling programming was presented, which we thought had a lot of potential. And in addition to that, broadening out the services that the Loudoun Museum can provide would also probably make a new set of volunteers be more likely to help out. Retired teachers and student interns were something, were two areas where we talked about. Hinging on a lot of the success of our recommendations is the implementation of a memorandum of understanding between the Loudoun Museum and the county that would, for the Loudoun Museum, establish a certain funding level that they could expect on an annual basis for the life of that MOU, as well as allow the county to incorporate some specific performance metrics as well as some fundraising level requirements that we would hope the museum would be able to meet. In addition to that, we imagine that the MOU would probably contain the charter for the executive oversight committee we've proposed, as well as the responsibilities of the development manager. Staff anticipates that in addition to all of that, the MOU would also have benchmarks that we would revisit on a regular basis to make sure that the county's funding and fundraising revenues still made sense. As the museum is able to increase fundraising revenues, the county could decrease its annual funding for the museum. Included in your item is a survey of other locally administered museums, which can give you a little bit more context to the discussion as well as some best practices. Just to quickly summarize the survey results that we found, most museums function as 501c3s. A lot of them are associated with historical societies within that locality. And what was really important to us was understanding that a lot of museums have a really strong base of volunteers or internship help that helps them really execute operations and programming. In addition, the survey includes some marketing strategies as well as partnership potentials that we think is really important for the museum going forward. The item also identifies a few issues that we wanted to bring up with the committee that we're aware of and that we need to work through and be realistic with this item. The first is that while the Loudoun Museum has been very engaged and a very productive member of the Museum Working Group, as Julie identified before, there is that turnaround plan that was presented to the board in 2012 that was never able to fully get off the ground. So we have some concerns that unless some of our recommendations are really implemented, we're concerned about the ability for the museum to reach its financial stability. And those two recommendations are really focusing on getting a development plan in place and hiring a development manager to implement and execute that development plan. Given its limited resources and budget, the museum has about $110,000 operating budget. They really are not able to fund the cost of that position as well as the development plan itself. So that's why our recommendation to you and to the board includes an additional funding amount in FY16 and FY17. Separately, we wanted to bring up in this item, though it wasn't a primary focus of the museum working group, was that the facility that the museum is located in as of right now has some serious structural and repair maintenance needs. And going forward, if the museum is able to get back on its feet and achieve financial stability, that facility and its location and the permanency of that facility is probably the next hurdle that we're going to have to talk to the museum about.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, if I could just summarize staff's recommendation. We are recommending that the board temporarily, I don't want to focus on that, temporarily increase the funding that is provided to the museum. Although we don't focus on it in the item, it is intended that this increase be in place only for a few years, long enough for an executive oversight committee to get its hands in the situation, to hire a development manager, and get that development manager to work to pay for its own position, as well as to support the museum. One thing I did want to point out, that this could be viewed as setting a precedent. We do have MOU with the Heritage Farm Museum, as you are aware. That is a little bit different situation, in that the county owns the facility and the building and the collection of the Farm Museum. But I did want to point out that this could be setting somewhat of a precedent. But given the unique nature and operations of the museum, one that hopefully would be able to justify and defend. Lastly, there are representatives from the museum here if the committee members have any questions of them.
So over to you. Was there discussion about what happens if the county does not provide additional funding?
Yes.
And or the allocation for the development manager?
Within the working group?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was clear that the museum will close its doors. We'll begin the dissolution process.
And what does that look like exactly in terms of the collection?
This is my view of it, which is a very simplistic view. If you want details, I'd have to ask Ms. Whiting to come up to the table. But it is a very complicated process. The collection of the museum is some were donations. Some are on long-term loan. So it's as far as I know, a fairly complicated legal process to untangle those, particularly those that run long-term loan and locating those donors and giving the collection back. As far as I know, it would take about 6 to 9 months to go through that dissolution process.
Okay. Well, we'll see where the discussion goes and if we need to delve into that more deeply. All right. Mr. Reed.
Thank you. Who appoints the oversight committee?
We ask that it be appointed by the county administrator.
And who appointed this committee that handle the museum working group?
Me. I guess you would say me. I put together individuals that I thought could come to the table with ideas and thoughts.
Can I ask why we didn't ask somebody from another museum, like the Sporting Museum or Morven Park, Oatlands, to sit on this body?
I don't have a good answer for that. I honestly don't. I focused on initially staff and then looking at our nonprofit community.
And the museum at one time, when it got cut back substantially, that was in 2008 when the county was dealing with a serious budget shortfall.
I believe it was around
They were getting about $200,000 from the county, and they had several staffers.
At one point, I believe they received over $300,000 from the
county. Did they have a development person at that time?
I do not know. I'd have to ask.
May I ask one of the museum people if they can? Is that okay, Mr. Chairman, if I can ask one of the museum people to come up or no?
Do you want to, you have one question or do you want to engage in a broader
discussion? I have a couple of questions. Like, for instance,
for the museum?
Is the entrance fee still $3?
Again, I defer.
Yeah, we can have a representative of the museum come up and answer those questions. So why don't you go back to your first question then for the museum.
Well, did you ever have a development manager or a fundraising manager?
We had a special projects employee, a large part of whose function was a development function. That was part of her job description.
What year was that?
That I know that position was abolished, I believe, in 2009, and she had been on board a couple of years.
And at that time, even, Julie, the museum was mostly getting county funding, wasn't it?
Yes.
Okay, so you weren't really raising much from a development manager, and that was during a time when the economy was really roaring pretty well, 2004, 5, 6. And is it still $3 admission?
Yes.
And why haven't you raised it?
We try to balance setting the admission at a level that has people come through the door and pay the admission and not look at the front desk and say the Smithsonian's free. It's a balancing act.
As you know, my building is right around the corner, and I frequently see people showing up on weekdays looking to see if the museum is open. You never had a sign. One of the things that I suggested when Supervisor Volpe was involved with this in 2012 was to just put a sign out to call one of your volunteers to come over and open the museum so you could get some traffic during the weekday. Did you ever do that?
No.
No.
We note at our website that you can arrange visits by special contact, and we do that.
Okay. So the number of visitors have dropped?
When we dropped the number of days we were open,
yeah,
yes.
But in the last 3 years, since it's only been open 3 days a week, the last 3 or 4, or even 5 years, has the museum's attendance increased, Julie, or anybody?
It's fluctuated. I mean, obviously it dropped when we went from 6 days to three.
Well, of course, but I mean, but, regime.
I believe within that 3 year period you're talking about, it has fluctuated somewhat.
Fluctuated. I honestly don't know what the additional funding is going to do. One more question. How much of the collection is in that? Which house is it at Edwards Ferry Road?
It's in one of the four houses at the very top of Edwards Ferry. I don't know exactly which. I don't know the address.
And that's most of the collection is there?
It's about 65% of the collection.
Okay, and so are you still accepting donations for the collection?
On a case-by-case basis, we have, for the most part, steered people away rather than try to encourage people to bring us new things.
The last 3 years you have taken donations, but you can't put it anywhere to display, right?
That's why we haven't accepted everything that's been tendered.
And people take a tax deduction for that, correct? But you have a curator. How come you didn't decide just to hire a development manager and went through all this a couple of years ago and just do a development manager and try to raise the money and said you have a curator? What's that for?
Well, the curator allows us to execute our obligation to safeguard the collection.
Mm-hmm. And the museum display has not really changed much in recent years, right? You don't have anything dealing with Loudoun history in the 20th century, or do you?
We do bring you up into the 20th century.
But okay. All right. Well, I mean, maybe I'll just reserve comment for later, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? At this point, we're only on questions. Mr. Bonfils?
Yes, a couple quick questions. I'm not 100% sure what the arrangement is for the building. Could you clarify that? Is there a rent, and how long, and what are the arrangements?
We have a dollar a year rent with the town of Leesburg for the buildings we're in. And that actually goes back to when we started life in the log cabin. And as they secured more, enlarged the facilities, the lease was expanded to cover those. And then we have a lease with the county for the facility that the bulk of the collection storage is in.
Okay. And that relationship with the town, is it got a finite limit to it, or is it on a year-to-year basis?
Let me jump in.
Sure.
I spoke with a representative of the town and asked that very question, and he indicated that there was no ending the arrangement in the foreseeable future.
Okay. That's good to know. Thank you. In your presentation, there was some discussion about the trustees. It wasn't a priority of the Board of Trustees for fundraising. As you know, I sit on a number of nonprofit boards, and that's generally the number one priority for the boards that I sit on. So I was a bit surprised by that. It sounds like the working group is interested in generating revenue to make this a standalone organization, which is what the goal would be. But I'm concerned a little bit about the prospects for doing that in the current environment. Can you enlighten me a little bit?
I think gradually we could transition the board to a financially giving board. And I don't want to imply that no member of the Board of Trustees contributes financially. There is at least one that contributes a significant amount and has for several years. But as you know, when you recruit a member to be a member of the board, I think the roles and the responsibilities need to be stated up front, and financial contribution should be stated up front and should be a condition of somebody being appointed to that board.
And I'd also like to add, the item speaks to it a little bit, but I just want to stress that the trustees are more of an operational board. They pitch in and volunteer, and a lot of their contributions are an in-kind contribution. So that's not to say the board members are not pulling their weight. It's just from a cash flow respect, that's where we were talking about.
And I appreciate that. The and it's not necessarily for a trustee or a board member for personal contributions, but also to solicit contributions from how I like to put this, non-government entities, corporations, you know, grocery stores, wherever to do that. And as you know, I've been known to do that. So I was a bit surprised by that. And it for this to be an ongoing concern, that kind of activity needs to be second nature. So those are all the questions I have right now, but thank you very much for your answers.
Okay. Mr. Bono?
Yes, thank you. You have 14 board members, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so while I was sitting here listening to these questions, I just went through your income statement and your balance sheet. You raised $10,500 from board members. So that's an average. And I know they don't all do this equally, and frankly, I don't care if they're volunteers and in-kind. That doesn't pay the bills. It really doesn't. That averages to $750 each in a year, and Supervisor Bonsfield's absolutely right. I feel like it's Groundhog Day, because over 2 years ago, we asked that you reconstitute your board and bring on the right people. And when we say a giving board, that board member doesn't have to give that money necessarily out of their own pocket. It would be nice if they did at least partial. But they can also raise money themselves. I mean, to run for supervisor, in a matter of 6 months, each one of us raises $50, $100, over $100,000 by ourselves just to run for this job. And I find it mind-boggling that the board members can't go out. And, you know, if I raised $100 each from 10 businesses, I've raised way above this average that you've got today. So I really feel that did you reconstitute your board based on the plan we asked for about 2 years ago?
We've attracted some new board members. We haven't succeeded in attracting board members who could meet our targets
Have you worked with the Chamber of Commerce, where we have some heavy hitter business people that solicit their help in constituting what I would call a real board? Have you reached out and asked the Chamber for help in constituting a board?
With the assistance of Beth Erickson, we've been set up for an appearance at the Chamber in January. And,
okay, but we've been talking about this for 4 years, and that's next January, and it's just a meeting. There is a nonprofit initiative under the Chamber of Commerce. There's over 100 nonprofits. Are you a part of that nonprofit initiative?
We've been active with their nonprofit group, yes.
The nonprofit initiative.
Let me step back and say I don't know nonprofit initiative in quotes. We've gone to some of their programs and training and have been very appreciative for those opportunities.
Okay. I think they could be a big help, because we asked 2 years ago that you reconstitute the board, and that obviously, if it happened, it didn't happen with the right reconstitution. How many visitors do you think you average a week? Do you want me to give you the answer, or do you want to go ahead?
I'm the last person I would trust with numbers from memory. I'm sorry, Supervisor.
But shouldn't you know how many visitors you average a week? I mean, that's core to bringing people to the door, is core to generating revenue. Shouldn't you know that? On average, roughly.
There's great fluctuation depending on the season.
On average.
I mean, what's 12 into 2,700?
Okay.
That would be the math. For the admissions, and then the events would have additional numbers.
Okay. I'll do the math for you. You raised $2,242 in admission charges according to your income statement from your 990, okay, which is what I was reading off of just now. That is divided by three, that's 747 visits a year, which constitutes 62 per month, which constitutes 14 visits in a week. 14 visits in a week. Now, I know you're not open every day, but if you were, that's about 2 to 2.5 people a day, okay, on average. That's not a great flow of visitors coming through this museum, and that's what worries me. I'm starting to wonder if there really is even a reason, because I get emails from people saying you need to support Loudoun Museum, and I ask them two questions, especially if somebody's talking to me about it. Number one, I'll say, have you ever gone to it? You know what answer I get routinely? No. Then I will say, well, have you ever contributed to the museum? No. Those are the answers I get every time. So I'm really starting to wonder if there is an interest in the community. I hear people say that, but it doesn't appear that that's being backed up by participation in the museum, and that's troubling to me. So we asked you for a turnaround plan. You put one together, which I appreciate, but it appears it didn't happen, that it never really got implemented. I'm trying to understand why it didn't get implemented. Do you want to comment on that, and then I'll be quiet?
Portions of the turnaround plan, I think we implemented extremely well, and that was to broaden our profile in the community, get our exhibits out in multiple locations, refresh what we were offering on site in the museum, part of what we tried to do to broaden our connection to the community is reflected in the redesign of our website and the fact that we're one of the few museums in the country where you can search the entirety of our database on the collections, and we found that that has brought people through the door, some of whom pay the $3 admission, some of whom may pay the senior admission rate of $1, some of whom may be military who get in for free. So the division by three to calculate the foot traffic isn't entirely accurate. But we attempted to attract new board members. We're excited with some of the additions there, but they do tend to have turned out to be roll-up-your-sleeves people. I think it's important to acknowledge the fact that with the level of staffing that we are operating at, we would not have discharged our duty to the community at all and to the collection that they've entrusted us with if we didn't have that roll-up-your-sleeves board. I'm the first to be anxious to attract some of the people who are much better fundraisers than I've ever proven to be. My fondest wish is to recruit my successor. But we also have to keep our doors open and show that we are taking care of what has been entrusted to us, or there's nothing to attract new board members to do. And so I can only apologize so far if that has occupied a lot of our time and effort, because that does take time and effort. But I know we let you down on reconstituting the board. I'm anxious to do so. I'll be the first person to travel around with my cane and show up where directed and let other people show their competence at fundraising.
Let me ask a question or two, because I haven't, and then I'll ask. We're just doing questions at this point, but I'll recognize Supervisor Higgins for questions. Would you be open to a fairly robust MOU with the county in which the county is providing very clear direction as to what we need to see done?
Yes.
Okay. Even if it seems like we're micromanaging?
You know, we will have to negotiate the terms of an agreement, but from day one, I think we've seen the management agreement you have with the Heritage Farm Museum as a useful template. We also looked at an agreement that Howard County, Maryland, has with a museum that is partially 501c3 and it's co-located in one of their library facilities.
Yeah, and I think if the board is to go forward with this type of agreement, there's probably going to have to be a significant amount of oversight from the committee, greater than what we previously have done. I'll save some of this for when we're in a motion, but I think we should have, in retrospect, gone to an MOU approach to begin with. I think we were all hoping that, you know, this would be a situation that could be handled through the private sector entirely. As I recall, the beginnings of this discussion was actually about trying to reduce all government support and have it entirely be privately funded. And now we've sort of, over the period of time, gone in the other direction. But I'll also just make the point, and then recognize Supervisor Higgins for questions, that at the end of the day, something has to be done with the collection. And there aren't any easy answers to that either. So, Supervisor Higgins, questions?
I don't really have a question. I have a comment, if that's appropriate, Mr. Chairman.
Well, why don't we get a motion on the table then, and which is more the policy question, and then we'll certainly recognize you for comment. I'm going to go ahead and move the Finance, Government Services, and Operations Committee recommend that the Board of Supervisors allocate $42,500 to the Latta Museum in FY16, direct staff to program $156,000 for the Latta Museum contribution in the FY17 proposed budget, establish an executive oversight committee for the purpose of providing assistance and guidance to the museum, and hiring a development manager who would be an employee of the museum to establish and execute development plan, and direct staff to develop a MOU between the county and the Latta Museum. Motion's made. Is there a second? There, seconded by Supervisor Bonfils. By way of opening, I'm not happy about being in this position either. I don't think anybody is. I think that the museum, I'm sure, tried to do what it could to keep itself relevant. I think there has to be some pretty significant changes to the museum, including the constitution of the board. Just as a resident of the southern part of the county, I don't think there's any connection whatsoever with anybody in my community with the museum. I don't think anybody knows it exists, except maybe through school projects. But I think we need to do a lot more to try to increase the profile across the county. And that includes even in the collection side, because sometimes the history in this county is focused in certain pockets of the county, which isn't necessarily where all the people are. And so I think perhaps there's some more that can be done to kind of create that sense of history with a lot of new residents in Loudoun County, a lot of people. I mean, I always give the statistic, 87% of my district moved in after the year 2000. So these are folks that don't have a huge connection to the history of Loudoun County anyway, because they came here from somewhere else, including me. And so we have to work to cultivate that a little bit. And that's true for throughout the county. But I, at this point, I don't see better options. I don't want to see the collection completely dispersed. I think that's the question that's really in front of us. If it is, then if the county were in the position of trying to take it over, so to speak, it would be pretty complicated, and it would probably end up costing us just as much. That said, I think we do need to be prepared at some point in time to cut the cord if it doesn't work. And that means, you know, if this MOU has to be a tight MOU, has to be a lot of oversight, I anticipate regular updates to the Finance Committee about how things are going, and then I anticipate perhaps a shelf life for how long we're willing to fund the development manager as part of this initial understanding. So that we have clear goals and everybody knows where we're going, and we will have to come up with a succession plan, so to speak, if it doesn't work. So I'll leave it at that for now. And we should be in timed on motions at 3 minutes. Supervisor Reed.
Point of inquiry, though. Is it your intent to bring this to the December 16th meeting? Should that be part of the motion? Because the term ends, and I think that would be wise.
Yeah. We'll need to go to part of the motion. 16.
Do you want to have Mr. Higgins ask his questions first?
Or I think he had just had comments, so I think we're in debate on the motion.
We'll I really, I'm just surprised that we're supporting the motion that was written in the packet. I mean, how many years can you kick the can down the road? And then you say, Mr. Chairman, that the Finance Committee will have regular meetings on this. Doesn't the Finance Committee, the Board of Supervisors, have more significant things to be talking about? Have you ever been to the museum? The collection hasn't changed. What they have on display in years is they don't have the staff and the resources. The upstairs is not used for the collection. It's used to more for storage and records. And what we're doing is here is we're sort of giving more government money to something that really doesn't know how to manage itself. And Ms. Whiting always comes to this board with something else to tickle us, to get us to think, oh, well, we're going to talk to the chamber next month, and we'll do this and we'll do that. Really, by doing this, by supporting this motion, colleagues, you're putting the county in a situation where the county administrator has to waste his time to appoint an oversight committee. And then what is that oversight committee going to be consisted of? Is it going to be consisted of people who are going to look at this with a cold eye, who are going to have marketing acumen? I mean, look what happened with this other committee. You're setting a precedent, as Ms. Granfield said, for the Loudoun History Museum and any other museum. You're going against your guidelines for nonprofit funding, because the nonprofit funding requires, I think, most of the money to come from other sources. The county is supposed to kick in a minority. And you're doing this for something where there's no interest. As you said, Mr. Chairman, there is no interest. Downtown Leesburg, which I think I have some expertise on, is now an attraction for dining, for the arts. It is not a thing that subsists on tourism to any great extent. It just isn't. And, you know, the museum hasn't raised their prices. They haven't done anything to try to get volunteers to come over during the week to get some revenue in. You know, without a change in the board of directors and a wholesale takeover by the county, this is just continued waste of money. So I would really urge my colleagues to vote against this. And if it comes to the 16th meeting, I would also urge a no vote as well. Thank you.
Other comments from committee members? Mr. Higgins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to be recognized here tonight. With all due respect, Mr. Reed, you have been trying to do away with the Loudoun Museum for your entire political career. I mean, when you were on the Leesburg Town Council, it started, that's 8 years ago, and you've been beating the same drum with whatever rhetoric since that time. So, you know, you don't like the Loudoun Museum, that's fine. The Loudoun Museum has a priceless collection, and the Loudoun Museum has seen the bottom fall out, and it's been on life support really since 2009. Their funding has been taken away by 90%. 90% of it's gone. So it's hard to do these things that you want to do when you don't have any funding to even keep the doors open, hardly. And, you know, it's hard to get people to travel to the museum when it's not open because you don't have any staff to keep it open. It is a priceless collection. Every time I've been in this building and we've brought any dignitaries to the county, first place we take them is down to the Loudoun Museum to see the Loudoun Museum. And so, you know, they have not done everything we had hoped they wanted. We hoped that we wanted them to do, but you know what? With the funding that they've had, it's amazing they've kept the lights on. And so I think the plan that the staff has brought forward is a very viable plan. It pretty much does what's been suggested here, with some wholesale changes in the structure that will allow the board to get on its feet and do the things that it does best, which are volunteer things, and find a board or another board, a different structure, to allow for fundraising. And, you know, Loudoun Museum is a priceless asset to Loudoun County. One of the reasons that people in the East don't know more about it is because all of the programs and outreach have evaporated because of no funding. We used to have an outreach program to the schools. We used to have other outreach programs. They brought hundreds and perhaps thousands of school kids into that museum every year. But we don't have that anymore because they don't have the arms and legs to get it done. I said, you know, so I say that I would hope that you would support this initiative. This is a recommendation that staff is bringing forward. They've looked at it deeply. They see the problems, and I think they've brought us a viable solution going forward. And it will take some serious restructuring and a different approach to the board and the museum, but I think in the end it can and will work, and it will allow us to maintain Loudoun's Museum, which is a valuable asset to the county. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Boffins.
I do have a question about the motion. It mentions the MOU and the timing. The so what would the timing be for the MOU? Would it be before the disbursement of the next set of funds?
And I think the other question is, does the MOU come back to the board? I think it would.
I'd like to consult with Mr. Rogers on that, but I would assume it would come back to the board.
The answer is yes.
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
Well, so if you want to link the funding with the MOU, is that where you're going with this?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Is there a mechanism to do that?
I think there is if we make one. Okay. I guess the question just would be, obviously the museum needs the money. What is the time frame in which the museum has to have that $42,000 by
from the staff perspective? The funding is specifically for the development manager and the development plan. It's not for operations.
Okay.
So linking it to the MOU is not an issue.
Okay. So, if you would like to suggest a friendly amendment, then
I would do so. I would like to make a friendly amendment. The motion would be to add the linkage between the funding and the MOU, and the MOU coming back to the Board of Supervisors.
I would suggest perhaps at the beginning of that motion just to say, upon ratification of an MOU by the Board of Supervisors, we shall allocate $42,500, and then the rest of the motion.
I agree.
Is that clear for staff? Okay.
That is my motion.
Okay. I would accept that as a friendly, and you are the seconder, so.
I accept it also.
Okay. Mr. Bonham.
I have no bone to pick with the museum. I just feel like we've spent 4 years talking way too much about this topic, and I really feel like we're going to be back here for the next 4 years, for those of us returning, talking about this topic. Why I hear there's no money, if I look at your income statement most recent, there's 40, I'm going to round the numbers, 45K of grant money from the county out of a 75K income budget. So the county is 60% of your budget right now. And then this is going to substantially beef that up. So I don't think it's fair to say at all there's no money. I think the fact is there's very little money that's not taxpayer money. I think that's a more fair statement. The other side of this is I feel like we've given you chance after chance, and I understand that Supervisor Higgins is passionate about this. I also feel he has a conflict of interest in this and shouldn't be voting. He's been a board member of your museum. He may still even be a board member of your museum. And I think that that creates a conflict as far as committing taxpayer dollars to a nonprofit. So I understand his passion. I understand his concerns about the collection. There are ways to preserve the collection if you were to dissolve. It can be protected. I realize it's not the most pleasant, but I don't think we're going to lose a collection. It can be preserved, and there are ways to do that, including other museums. And I'm just to the point where we have gone this circle and circle, and nothing has gotten done. The plan hasn't been implemented. And this is no offense to you, Ms. Whiting, but maybe we need some other people that can get the plan implemented, that can get it done, because it didn't happen. And we're talking about some of the same things now that we talked about with the last plan, and that was reconstitute the board. And if it happened, it didn't happen successfully. And those are what my concerns are. I can think of 20 people I'd love to have on your board that would get the money raised. But I'm not gonna put them on the hook to do that. But the fact is, you need somebody that's going to implement a plan that does have the ability to do that, okay? And I think that they would be willing to do that. And the amount of money we're talking about to make this museum viable is not extraordinary. My problem is it just can't be mostly taxpayer money year after year. And if you look back when the county was funding you at higher levels, the county was even more than 60% of your budget. And so I feel the taxpayers have foot this bill for a long time, and we continue to go down the same path. So thank you.
Okay, well, I will give my closing. Look, I've been tough in the past on this and on this topic in general, and I will continue to be. I think what it comes down to is, should Loudoun County have a museum of this nature as a presence in the county? If you look at other jurisdictions in Northern Virginia and elsewhere, most of them do. And most of them are a lot perhaps better managed and more robust than this one is, and there's a reason for that. I view this as a last-ditch attempt to give it a final shot at trying to save it with a lot more direct county involvement than what we've had in the past. Before, the board said to the Loudoun Museum, please go do these things, and then that was it. This time around, there will be concrete consequences if the metrics aren't met, and if the plan doesn't work. It'll be laid out because it's an MOU between the county and because we are funding the position. We will suspend funding that position, and then, you know, what happens. But I think I'm willing to give it one more shot to try to preserve the collection. I understand what was said, but I've looked into this a little bit. I don't think it's going to be easy at all to keep that collection together. I think that, you know, that either the county would be on the hook for storing it, and then what are we going to do with it? If we start displaying it on our own, then we're going to run into the same operational costs that we have now. So I do think that Supervisor Bono is right. I think there are some people in the county that could get more active in this that have the ability to save it. But I think it's going to take the impetus of the county in order to actually make that happen. Because I don't mean any disrespect at all, but I think just the museum coming in and asking is not going to cut it, and it hasn't cut it to this point. So I think if the county's behind it for a brief period of time, hopefully a 2 to 3 period of time, I think that might attract what we need to have to bring to that board. So we'll see what the recommendation is of the committee, and then it will go to the full board. All in favor of the motion, say aye. Aye. All opposed? No. The committee vote is 2-2 with Chairman York absent for the vote. The committee will be moving forward to the Board of Supervisors without a recommendation on this. Without a recommendation on this item.
If I may be recognized, can I make an alternative motion?
You may, as a member of the committee. Yes.
I would like to move that we donate $42,000 to the Loudoun Museum for the purposes of dissolving the museum and distributing the collection properly for just the next 6 months.
Motion is made. Is there a second? There is not.
Thank you. So this will go to the board on the 16th. But
this item will go to the board on the 16th without a recommendation. Mr. Hampstreet.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to point out that the funding that the board has previously given to the Loudoun Museum, according to them, is sufficient for dissolution, so they should not require additional funding if that's where the board wants to go.
Okay. All right. We have a couple of topics coming up that are probably even tougher than that one was. So let's go ahead and take a 10-minute break. All right. We back? Okay. We're going to pick up with item 7, which is annual debt issuance guideline. This is an item that we placed on the agenda a few days ago. So we've been having this discussion about debt issuance guidelines for some time, and I asked the question at a finance committee meeting a while ago along the lines of, our budget's been increasing for a long period of time, and yet we haven't increased our debt cap, which is a self-imposed debt cap. It would seem logical that as the county's overall budget grew, that we could also increase our debt issuance. And so an item came back to the board over the summer. The report was pretty unequivocal that we shouldn't consider changing our debt cap over the $200 million that it's currently set at. We had our bond counsel visit us. They ran some scenarios, and the board elected to keep the debt cap the same. This has still been an ongoing subject of discussion. Others have discussed it. I have continued to discuss it with the county administrator, and we now have some different advice. So, Mr. Sandy, Mr. Hempstreet, I don't know which one of you want to start the conversation, but Mr. Sandy.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, Finance Committee members. What you have in front of you again this evening is the discussion about the debt cap. Since our recommendation in July, we've continued to review our debt situation. We've continued to run scenarios, and this evening we're recommending to raise that debt limit up to $225 million based on a rolling CPI five-year average, and have the board look at it again in the sixth year of the CIP. So we would be recommending you changing your fiscal policies to do that level $225 million debt cap. Right now, your fiscal policy states $200 million. The purpose really is at looking at it, you know, the debt cap has been in place for a number of years since 2006. 2004 to 2006, it was increased in that two-year period. Again, it hasn't been looked at in 10 years. We've looked at it throughout the summer, ran some different sensitivity analysis based on the CIP under development, in addition to looking at what our economic situation was in terms of what we provided from July. In July, that item showed you a scenario that was based on a severe downturn with very static expenditures and revenue growth, but it was a $25 million increase or $50 million increase per year in debt. So,
Wait a minute, John, that's an important point. So let me make it clear on that. The scenario that the committee was presented included a $50 million increase in the debt cap every year.
Yes, it included $50 million in new debt issued per year, and relatively
new debt or increase in the debt cap.
Increase in debt.
$250 million, assuming that the $250 million had been sold every year of the CIP.
Right. Just to be clear, what we're talking about is the limit on new debt issuance in any given year. And so right now the limit on new debt is $200 million. We also have a guideline that deals with total debt issued, which is farther down the sheet. I don't have it in front of me, but that number is much higher. So we're talking about new debt that's issued.
Let's see. Is that the $1.69 billion in 17?
Yes. Okay. That's the cumulative debt.
Okay.
So with that scenario in July, there were two scenarios run in July. One really showed you a severe economic downturn, very static expenditures, revenue situation, and that additional debt per year, which at that point your debt to expenditures ratio limit was breached in the out years. What we've done now is we've certainly reran a scenario, a number of different scenarios, looking at it at a number of different levels, and in your packet itself in attachment 2, you'll see the scenario that we're presenting this evening, which is based on the CIP under development, both the schools and county, and with the projected debt for the six-year CIP period, and then looking at your new debt issuance guideline, if that was established at 225 for 5 years of the CIP based on that CIP rolling index, and then adjusted to 250 in 2022. And you can see that the first 2 years there's a breach in that debt limit, but under the current guideline of 200, the first 3 years are breached. The reason why we decided to use a CIP rolling five-year average, we also looked at the Turner Construction Index. So since new debt limit has not been raised since 2006, you know, it stayed at a level amount. It's not reflected any changes in labor costs or construction costs. We looked at the Turner Construction Indices to compare it with the CPI. That construction indices is much more dynamic. It's more volatile. There's more elasticity based on world events and construction prices and labor costs. We thought the CPI period was a more fiscally conservative approach, a flatter index to use to peg any recommendation we might have. And we're making that recommendation at 225, as I've mentioned. The reason why we're not providing a recommendation higher to that is there is, you know, in the out years, there are concerns that your 10% PAYGO requirement as part of your fiscal policies could get very high. So 225 seemed to be the right approach for the recommendation for this evening.
Okay. I'm sure there are going to be questions. Mr. Reed.
Okay, so this is not going to affect our bond rating, or will it?
No, sir. In terms of the overall, what the rating agencies typically look at, they look at those four debt ratios that you see in the mid part of the table, especially the debt to expenditures table, or the debt to expenditures ratio. Mm-hmm. We talked with our fiscal advisors, our financial advisors, about what we were preparing this evening for this recommendation. They thought that it was appropriate and certainly appropriate with a good explanation. And
so
that explanation is basically that the debt limit has been static since 2006.
That's true, but I mean, is there some sort of policy reason? Like, are we doing this because of these new schools or something to get them into the CIP to give the board more wiggle room over projects it wants? Because I'm looking at your cash requirement here. It's going to go to $54 million and then drop to 32 and then to 18 and then back. It's going to start going back up. Am I looking at the right table? Local tax funding impact, $54 million in fiscal 17.
Yeah, that is the additional funds that would have to go to PAYGO once you got into that year, and that would assume that you
have to raise taxes to cover this.
That would assume that you went to every penny of what that new debt guideline would be. In many years,
well, just to clarify, though, it doesn't mean you have to raise taxes. It just that's a hit that's somehow needs to be incorporated in the budget.
That's correct.
You're talking about $469,000. Ranging up to $12.7 million in FY 2022, at which point the county budget is projected to be what?
But $2.3 billion.
Yeah, it's so. The one thing I would point out too, again, that assumes that you would that we would issue every penny up to the $225 million level.
And that could happen
for each and every year.
And that could happen because of the schools that the superintendent wants and all the other projects, some of which I think are pork barrel, frankly. I mean, total cash requirements is $54 million for fiscal 17. So how much of that is tax dollars versus proffers or something else? It's all tax dollars. So.
That's the same regardless, right?
That's the same regardless based on the CIP that, under development.
Yeah, I know I'm looking at the yellow line, but then you see, look at that whopping increase in the yellow line, but then I'm looking at it dropping in 18, dropping in 19, and then going back up. I'm looking at that bottom total cash requirement. I'm sorry, but I'm fixated on that. Why does it drop and then go back up?
Yes. You just have to remember that is based on the CIP that's just currently under development at this point. So there will be likely changes by the school board, likely changes by you as a board when you undergo and review that CIP. So that scenario is, at this point, the highest case. And it also assumes, again, that we will issue every penny of that debt for each and every one of those years.
Well, I'll tell you folks, you know, there's a lot of pressing needs in that CIP. And I remember when VDOT had no money, they basically, along with the CTB, took projects out. They just took them out. Transportation projects that, you know, frankly, some were really critical until the stimulus money came along, and then they could put some back in. And the TPB, and we were talking about the TPB earlier, the chairman and I, and you know, they had to take stuff out of the CLRP because VDOT couldn't pay for them. And that I think is the most sensible thing to do, or to make some of these schools bigger. I mean, I don't know why we can't make some of the schools bigger as per the pilot study that we did in 2012. And the school board has never updated those guidelines. Those 2010 capacity guidelines have never been revised. And the Board of Supervisors has been negligent on that, too. So, you know, I'm a little concerned here. I'll listen to the rest of the debate, see which way I'm going to go. But just looking at those numbers, it just gives you pause.
Well, I think what you have to understand is this. I almost wish you hadn't put this chart in, because this is showing you a hypothetical scenario based on a CIP that nobody up here has seen that doesn't exist yet. And there's various reasons why the numbers jump around, one of which is we haven't appropriated out all of this. So I think most of the concerns that Mr. Rees is expressing have to do with what ends up in the CIP, not what the CIP structure is. Mr. Hemstreet. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I was going to say in response to Supervisor Reed's questions, what this item is about is to give me guidance as to how to prepare the budget, okay? Because right now, it's a very different CIP if the new debt limit is $200 million versus the new debt limit being $225 million. So I don't want, as you just indicated, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to get too bogged down, or I would encourage the committee not to get too bogged down in actual projects. It's more about, hey, it's exactly how you begun the discussion, Mr. Chairman, which is you and I have continued to have dialogue since July about whether or not there could legitimately be movement in this number absent projects, which is what we recommended to the board in March. If you want to look at the new debt issuance limit, the time to look at it is when you're outside of the budget process. And so the challenge that you have before you is the four ratios that are the most important, which are those that are in the middle of the page. We are all well under those limits at the $200 million limit. Even if you go to a much higher number, and so we have put some numbers in here for illustration, you're still well under those ratios, which are what is a driving factor in your AAA. Okay, and so if the board is interested in modifying that new debt issuance limit, our recommendation would be that you do that now, or you do it next summer after you're outside the budget process. However, there will be pressure on the budget. You all have already acknowledge that, and so my suggestion would be that you don't have a discussion around a new debt limit cap in the middle of the budget process. And so this really is my request to you as the guidance as to how do you want the FY17 CIP developed, and what set of rules do you want me to apply to that when we put together a proposal. The other thing that I would point out is the debt issuance and cash are two different numbers. So your fiscal policy requires 10% cash as a match in the CIP. It's a $2 billion six-year CIP. So in every year of the CIP, your appropriation schedule is anywhere between $500 million to $300 million. It depends on the number of projects in that year, and then backed into how the debt that supports those appropriations is issued, because the debt is issued over a number of years. And so that is why you see in 1 year a $54 million cash match, because you've got $540 million in appropriations in that year. Perhaps there's a couple high schools. Perhaps there's also a large road in there like Belmont Ridge Road or something like that. That's the appropriation schedule. You're required to put cash in that year. Another year, because you're hitting your debts, your new debt issuance, because of how the debt ties back to the appropriation schedule, you can only afford $340 million in appropriations that year, which means your cash contribution is lower. So those numbers are not exactly one-to-one, but they are related to each other, and hopefully that helps explain how they're related.
Okay. Other questions, Mr. Bona?
I'm not sure they're really questions, but okay. I do agree with Mr. Hempstreet in that if we're going to do this, and that's if, now is the time to do it. I completely agree with that. One of my questions, and I'm not sure, it was partially answered, but why the big change in such a short amount of time? We had this right in front of this committee with a completely 180-degree recommendation less than 2 months ago. Is it because we now see this massive school request on the CIP? What is it that made us flip completely in less than 2 months from a staff recommendation perspective?
The only thing I can say to that is that we've been looking at it all along, ever since the spring, ever since, and certainly since February, when I believe Supervisor Letourneau raised it as part of the budget work session. We ran a couple scenarios in the summer. One of those, I believe, was a very draconian scenario. We went back and looked at providing new scenario development and talking with our financial advisor. And we felt, certainly when I started working with the team, that looking at past decisions by the Board of Supervisors on this ratio, it had been moved a couple times, and it had not been looked at really for decades.
John, you're not running for office. What flipped? What changed 180? I know it hasn't moved since 2006. It's been a decade. What's different today than to cause you to do a 180 different recommendation than just 2 months ago? Your recommendation was keep it where it was 2 months ago to this committee.
Well, I think we had a scenario in there that did show that it was going to be able to keep us within the four ratios. And I think that what happened was there was focus, intense focus on the scenario that it didn't keep us to that.
All right, so let me comment on that. So, I understand completely that this keeps us within our ratio targets. I understand that completely. I understand that you've done a pro forma of what I would call a mild recession, not a recession that's like the 2008-2009 recession, but let's call it just an economic downturn, and that you perform at that, and we're within our limits. And I understand that it is something we could do, and that the appropriations don't align with the theoretical way we program a CIP under a cap, okay? One thing I've observed, though, is we always bloat to the cap in the CIP in the front years of the CIP all the time, because stuff shifts to we want it now. And look at the one you're about to propose. It's overbloated in the front 2 or 3 years, 2 years at least, and then all of a sudden it falls off way below the cap. And every year we're bloated to the first 1, 2, 3 years. So it's always, I want this now. I may support this when it comes to the full board. I'm not going to support it tonight. Here's my issue. There's two issues. It takes cash and it takes cash. It takes cash because of the 10% pay-as-you-go. And that yellow line in here is pretty clear what that cash difference is. And additionally, the debt service payments will increase at a higher rate each year. And that takes cash. So for two different reasons, we're going to require more local tax funding. And it's about, if I look at this chart, it's a penny or two in future years, 19 and beyond, on the tax rate. I agree that's a budget issue for the county administrator to recommend. But it does put a future board, and maybe the next board even in its later years, into the dilemma of it's two more pieces of cash we need in the budget to fund this stuff when there's always competing priorities. And that's what makes this kind of a difficult decision, is that piece of it. I realize we don't issue bonds the way it's laid out in the CIP, and it can be 300 one year and 400 one year and 100 another year. But at the same time, the cash has to follow the project. Sometimes that cash, it's not all at once either. That cash could be, it's pay as you go. It's not pay it all up front. So it can be when you take down those bonds for that project at different times. So my problem with this becomes not taking it to 225, not that we don't pro forma it into our targets. My problem is the two issues with cash that it causes us to have to come up with in the future from the local tax transfer. So thank you.
All right, let me ask a couple questions. First of all, do we issue debt all the way to the cap every year?
No, we actually look at the projects that are currently ongoing and how much they need before we issue the debt. There's some guidelines, IRS guidelines, that prohibit us from selling debt for a project that we don't reasonably expect to move forward. So if a project is delayed for some reason, we will delay the debt service.
So, all right, so right now our debt cap's at 200 on new debt, but what are we actually issuing on average? Because, again, I think Supervisor Bono, but he was talking about the CIP, which, again, is different than what the actual debt that's issued is.
In 2015, we issued $160 million, a little over
$160 million. What was the amount on the CIP that year budgeted? Anybody have that?
It was $194 million.
$194.
In 2014, we issued $125.1 million.
And, again, what was that CIP number? The point I'm trying to make is I don't think that it's fair to say that we actually do blow to the cap when it actually comes down to issuing debt. We don't.
Right.
Yeah, but that's
our actual debt expenditures are usually lower than what we budget, which is
yeah.
A good thing.
All right. The second thing is I need to try to rehabilitate this a little bit, I think, because Mr. Sandy, this is going to come up, and I understand it's an uncomfortable conversation, but you're not going to get through the board with this. It's quite clear, unless we have a little bit more candid discussion about what happened and what didn't happen. So was it your recommendation, or was it somebody else's recommendation at the time on keeping the debt cap where it was?
It was somebody else's recommendation.
Okay, so you took over management of the department, essentially.
In mid-April, yes.
And you reevaluated at that time. But the item came after you took over. But at that time, had you not simply gotten to this item or not begun your own analysis of this issue?
I was part of reviewing that item, but I had not had a chance to direct a lot of sensitivity analysis related to it, looking at the historical perspective, which I've had a chance to do now.
Okay. So you're coming to us now with what is your recommendation as opposed to the previous recommendation?
Yes.
Okay. I think that needs to be understood. I'm going to go ahead and make a motion. We'll see what happens. I move the Finance Government Operations Committee recommend to the Board of Supervisors to amend the current fiscal policy to increase the annual debt issuance guidelines of $200 million to $225 million. And I further move the fiscal policy include an adjustment to the debt issuance guideline every 5 years based on the CPI five-year rolling average after appropriate review. Second. Motion is made, seconded by Supervisor Bonfils. All right, look, I guess I got us into this mess in the first place by bringing this up. I do think, and I think I had this discussion with the county administrator, that there's a little bit of a credibility problem when staff comes to us with a strong recommendation and then reverses it a few months later. And I think that cannot continue to happen, and we've had that discussion. I also think that for those of you who are more intimately familiar with the personnel situation going on in management and financial services at the time, it's a little bit more understandable and it's a situation that probably would not repeat itself due to particular circumstances at that time. So I am willing to cast my lot, so to speak, with our current management team and Management Financial Services and their recommendation. I do want to say very clearly, though, that I don't think we should be doing this if the only reason we're doing it is to try to accommodate some sort of CIP coming this year. This has nothing to do with, even though it doesn't seem like it has nothing to do with this discussion going on at the schools right now. I said back in February I thought we should be looking at this regularly as a best practice because the county's changing rapidly and because our needs are shifting. I understand that in future years it's probably going to require more cash to go into this, but I also think that's an appropriations decision that can be made every year by the board. And if we don't have the money, we're not going to appropriate the cash regardless of what the debt limit is. If we have a negative situation like we've had in the past in the county, the board reacted to that, the previous board reacted to that by taking projects out of the CIP, and I think that that will continue regardless of what the debt cap is. But if the ability is there to fund it, then and all of our ratios are not just met, but met solidly under these scenarios. And if you look at it, the chart on A2, oh, yeah, we should be running the clock on a motion. Sorry, and I'm probably almost out of time. Under those four ratios here, you look at where our targets are. You know, we're not just meeting them. We're meeting them by, you know, healthy margins throughout the period. So it doesn't make sense to unilaterally put ourselves in a more difficult position than we need to be in. And I think that's what we're probably going to do here if we don't raise the cap. Supervisor Bonham.
Yeah, let me ask a question. The second half of the motion, does this mean that we will automatically, after appropriate review, automatically change the debt issuance guideline based on the five-year rolling average of the CIP? In other words, what I'm saying is, every 5 years, is it going to be adjusted without Board of Supervisor approval?
No. What that means is that we will bring the numbers back to you every 5 years for you to consider it again as a part of your policy guidance.
So there, API, so
there would
CIP.
Be there would be a regular
CIP, the Consumer Price Index.
Yes, right. It'll be a regular. So it'll
be a regular
review that comes back to the board every 5 years.
All right. Let me offer up a friendly amendment to clarify the second half of that motion that says, after appropriate review, it will be brought to the Board of Supervisors for approval.
That's fine with me. Jim?
It's good. Great.
Okay.
And just to finish, I'm going to abstain tonight. I've got to think this over before it comes to the full board. Is this coming next Wednesday?
Yes, sir. Yes. But the reason being, if you're, I need to prepare a budget, and so if you're going to change the guidance, I really need that by next week.
Sorry.
Just an information point. This would automatically come to the board because it changes the fiscal policy. The debt ceiling guidance would automatically come to the board.
Just making it crystal clear.
Okay. Other comment on the motion? All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. I think the motion passes 301 with Supervisor Bonham abstain. 3011. And Chairman York absent for the vote. Okay. FY 2017 budget outlook update. Who gets to be the bearer of bad news?
Be me.
That would be you. Okay, Erin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the item that's before you this evening is an update to the FY17 budget outlook that has been precipitated by a change in our outlook for real property, our estimates that were given to you in September. So we're coming to you with a discussion that focuses primarily on that change and what that means. And it does, the change in our real property outlook would affect the guidance that we were given in September for preparing the budget. So we are asking that you consider revisiting the guidance. If you look on page 2 of the item, iPad page 61, there's a table at the top of that page which shows you the difference between the September outlook and the November estimate that we've received from CORE to date on the real property portfolio. If you look at that, you can see a couple things stand out. We were looking for a value change in the portfolio of somewhere in the neighborhood of 6%, and now we're seeing more like 2%. That has a significant impact on the portfolio, and the real property value on January 1st, 2016 will be approximately $2.3 billion lower than we expected. You can also see that the appreciation of existing properties has also not shown the growth that we would like to see. In fact, it has actually gone negative at this point. So that affects the equalized rate, the calculation of the equalized rate. Right now we're estimating that the equalized rate is actually higher than the current rate. It would be $1.14.5. So as I said, that does affect your guidance. If you turn over to, I guess, page 4 of the item, iPad page 63, you can see an updated table 1. This is the table that appeared in the September outlook and the item there. Basically, the bottom line is that on real property, the new numbers have affected our real property estimates on the order of about $30 million. Now, when we add in the fund balance that the board approved for use in the 17 budget at your last meeting, as well as some changes to our debt and capital expectations, the total change in the shortfall is not $30 million, but you can see that the shortfall is sizable. At the current rate, our shortfall was previously about $76 million. Now it's $82 million. I will also note that one change from this item from September is we've updated with current information from the superintendent based on his memo to the school board in October, which did have an increase included as well for new student growth, as well as some other items. I will caveat all of this by saying that we are not complete on getting the revenue picture. CORE has not completed all of the assessments, so there is some potential that these numbers could be slightly different. We also do not have the state budget, which could have some revenue changes for us, particularly in K through 12. So we are by no means final as far as asking for your guidance. We will be coming back to the board in January to seek final guidance that will guide the final preparation of the proposed. But at this point, we wanted to come to you and give you an update about where we are and the effect that these numbers have on the guidance that we were given in September.
Okay. Well, we are in a new paradigm for us, at least those of us that have only been on the board for this term. But we have not been in a situation where we have been effectively downgrading our outlook as the process gets underway, and that's where we are. And so I think there's going to have to be expectations that need to be readjusted as we move into our discussions with the schools in particular. And I think we're working on means to communicate these updates to the school board and the superintendent. But obviously, essentially a real reduction in property values for residential, given how much of that base it is in our tax revenue, is going to have an impact, and that's really where we are. So, Mr. Reed first.
Well, this week I'm observing Hanukkah, the miracle of the oil, and I pray for a miracle for all you guys that maybe, just like the flask of oil that lasted 8 days for my ancestors back in the Second Temple days, that maybe that $8 million from a tax increase, maybe a 1 cent increase can be stretched to $80 million or something. But anyway. Well, this is definitely a kick in the stomach. if I were back next year, I would probably support a tax increase. I have no problem supporting our schools. But what really kills me, Aaron, is what happened. I mean, Congress just passed a budget without sequestration. And does the Dulles Area Association of Realtors or CoStar or anybody foresee anything that could change between now and January 1st when they're supposed to do that snapshot in time for taxes? Or we're basically going to be relying upon this depressed market?
Dulles Area Realtors reported that at the end of September that the big inventory increase that the county experienced at the beginning of the year had been worked off. The available inventory at the end of September was actually lower than it was September a year ago. But the realtors characterize the market now as balanced. They say it has shifted back more in favor of sellers, but they see it as more of a balanced market. We are at the present time assuming that looking ahead to next year that we'll see at least 1% appreciations, when we'll get back some of what we lost. But you know, given what the realtors are saying, given the fact that we're probably looking at at least a small increase in interest rates when the Federal Reserve meets later this month.
What about business taxes? I take it that a lot of this decrease, commercial values down. I know the feeling. I own a commercial building in Leesburg. Are you anticipating any movement by commercial property owners to seek reductions in their taxes?
I just got two questions.
And what about revenue from business, BPOL, and other sources?
We do anticipate some increase in BPOL. All of our other tax sources are doing reasonably well. Sales taxes were up about 5%. TOT tax in FY15 was up like 20%. We're not looking for increases like that going forward, but personal property taxes on computer equipment, data centers has been growing at 20% a year. And again, we're not looking for that kind of increase going forward. But no, all of the other revenue sources have been doing reasonably well. I think what you have to realize is that the region, the Washington, D.C. region, and you can see this in the employment growth figures, in 2014, employment growth in the region was pretty low, much lower than it was for the nation as a whole. Now, that seems to be turning around. The most recent data we have for the region and for Loudoun, of course, is for like the first and second quarters of this year. But employment growth is accelerating. It's more in line with what we're seeing nationwide. And we're even seeing employment growth in the business and professional services job categories, which is encouraging, because that was an area, as any of you who follow Dr. Fuller at GMU, that's something that he had been saying repeatedly. We're losing jobs, and we're losing jobs in the business and professional service classes. So in this outlook, we're trying to factor in some improvement for the future, but not trying to overdo it also.
Mr. Hamstreet, how does this compare to the, I know you weren't here in 2008, or I don't think you were, but how does this compare to what that new board going into 2008 had to deal with? Because they had to make some significant cuts. Is this about as bad, or?
This is not even close to what they went through. I mean, if you look at what happened with them, they, as has been alluded to earlier, they more or less suspended the CIP. You actually saw the budget reduce in fiscal 11 and fiscal 12. You know, one of the things that's happening is you see a lag between the event and when it actually hits property value. So, for example, the Great Recession was between 2007 and 2009. It didn't impact our budget until fiscal, really strongly impact our budget until fiscal 10, fiscal 11, fiscal 12. And so, really, this is kind of the impact of sequestration, which was 2 years ago, which is now coming and flowing through your.
So we're not going to see the benefit of this new budget that they passed for another 2 years, probably. Well, I will just say this, that, you know, I would venture to guess that if this board had not come up with zoning changes to boost business development, business incentives to bring business into this county, it would have been a lot worse. I really believe that. And we've done a lot this last 4 years to make sure that we don't have what happened back in 2008. So it doesn't look great, but I'm confident that the board and the school board will come to its terms, and the public is not going to want to see a massive increase in taxes, because looking at that rate there, I think you'd have to raise it, what? You know, to come up with what the school board wants, a fully funded budget, what is that, about a 10-cent increase in the tax rate? Am I looking at that correctly?
A little less, but you're not way off.
I'm not way off. Okay, well, I'll shut up and get out now. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Bonham.
Yes, thank you. Let me make an observation and tell me if you think I'm correct here. From what I'm seeing, residential values, I'm going to paint a broad brush, are up slightly. They're just not up as much as we thought. Correct? And that, well, let me keep going. But it looks like condos and townhouses actually are down slightly, and single-family attached is up a little bit. My observation is this. Whatever the tax rate ends up being, single-family detached homeowners are going to get hit even harder here. In general, again, a broad brush, because their values are up, and folks in townhouses and condos are theoretically, on average, going to go down a little bit. Is that a fair observation?
Yeah, that's fair. If the board were to adopt an equalized tax rate, right, which basically says the average taxpayer is going to pay approximately the same tax bill, if your property went down less than the average, you're going to pay a higher tax bill.
Again, it's all about the average and not your personal situation. The other side of this, and it is to cover the full gap at the equalized rate, the tax rate would probably be roughly about $1.25, and roughly, okay? Might be a little less, but it's not far away from that. My other question is this. You have a motion in the packet, and I'm not sure the second half of this motion makes any sense anymore, so I want to understand your logic. Right now, the motion would be to prepare the FY17 proposed budget at the equalized tax rate. Well, that's now no longer $1.115, it's $1.145. Right. And so the reason before we had you do $1.115 in the current rate of $1.135 was we could see at the equalized rate we fund this, but at the current rate, which would be a tax increase, we could also fund this. This is now a reverse situation. So the equalized rate is actually above the current rate. So all it would show us is a little bit, to the tune of maybe $7 million, something like that, what we could cut from the equalized rate, yet we have a $75 million problem right now at the equalized $1.145. Therefore, I'm not sure the second half of this motion, to provide options to allow current real property tax rate, really makes much sense anymore. And I'm not sure we should proceed with that part of it in a motion here tonight. I think right now maybe it needs to just be at the $1.145 equalized rate.
Yeah, so what they gave us was just the existing motion. And I think at this point what we should do is eliminate the existing property tax rate as guidance for the county administrator and proceed only with the equalized tax rate. Did you need to? Yes.
I was just going to try to clarify the motion, Mr. Chairman. Right now, we don't know where the equalized rate for sure is going to be, right? So as Ms. McClellan indicated earlier, if the assessments get better, the equalized rate could be, again, below the $1.13.5, or it could be higher than $1.14.5. So what we're trying to do is do a motion that said, hey, whatever you do, the budget should include both options at the equalized rate and the current tax rate, you know, just because we're not sure where the two are going to lie relative to each other at this point in time.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and move that the Finance, Government Services, and Operations Committee recommend that the Board of Supervisors direct the County Administrator to prepare the FY17 proposed budget at the equalized property tax rate. Motion's made. And second, I don't think we have to belabor the point, but it's not going to do us any good at this point to come in with reduction options, since they're not actually going to be reduction options. Any further comment on this? All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? No one's opposed. The motion carries 4-0-1. All right, we have one item, well, one and a half, we'll call it, items left. We're going to discuss the monthly report implementation of the ERP project, as always, and has become our custom recently due to ongoing situations. We are first going to convene in closed session to discuss that situation. So I will move the Finance, Government Services, and Operations Committee recess this public meeting and enter into closed session pursuant to Virginia Code 2-2-3711A7 for actual or probable litigation and for a consultation with legal counsel and briefings by staff on the contract with AST Corporation for the implementation of ERP. Second. Motion is made, seconded by Supervisor Bona. All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries 4-0-1. We will retire to the Levittsville room. I move that the closed session be adjourned, that the Finance, Government Services, and Operations Committee reconvene its public meeting, and that the minutes of the public meeting should reflect that no formal action was taken in closed session.
Second.
Motion is made and seconded by Supervisor Bono. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries 401. Chairman York absent. I move the resolution certifying the closed session be adopted and reflected in the minutes of this public meeting.
Second.
Motion is made and seconded by Supervisor Bono. All in favor?
Aye.
Motion carries 401. Chairman York absent. I move that the Finance Committee recommend to the Board of Supervisors that the County Administrator terminate Loudoun County's contract with AST and initiate debarment proceedings.
Second.
Motion is made. Seconded by Mr. Reed. Any comment? All in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion carries 401. Chairman York absent for the vote. I have one further option or further item before the board. Going back to item number eight and the motion that, sorry, item number, yeah, eight on fiscal guidance. I move that the motion adopted be reconsidered. Motion's made and seconded by Supervisor Vona. All in favor of reconsideration, say aye.
Aye.
Motion carries 401. I move a substitute motion that the Finance Committee recommend to the Board of Supervisors that the County Administrator prepare an FY17 budget at the equalized tax rate and the current tax rate, unless the current rate is lower than the equalized rate. In such event, the Administrator should prepare a budget at the equalized rate.
Second.
Motion's made, seconded by Supervisor Bona. This is just to clarify in the event that the numbers move around further. It gives the County Administrator a little bit more flexibility than what we adopted. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
No one opposed. Motion carries 401. Chairman York absent for the vote. And I should have also clarified that item 10, item 9, which was the monthly implementation report of ERP, is no longer necessary in light of the board's motion. That is the concluding item for the Finance Committee, and this is the concluding meeting of the Finance Committee. Thank you very much for all the committee members for your service. Thank you to Mr. Bona, who for over 3 years led the committee, and I have enjoyed taking it on and hope to continue to do so in the next board's term. Thank you to Mr. Reed for all your service to the committee, Mr. Bonfils for stepping in for Mr. Williams, and, of course, we'll have a lot of thank yous for Chairman York next week. Most of all, thank you to our staff for sitting through these committee meetings. These are long and tough meetings late at night. Our budget staff, most of whom aren't here anymore, but some of you are, thank you for sticking with us and dealing with the thorny issues, and I look forward to working with you again for the next 4 years. We are adjourned.